raise a point, which was pending.
Go ahead.
I can't remember what it was.
It was very important, though.
With respect to whether there should be an enunciation in the code with respect to the state law or not.
Couldn't hear you, George.
Whether you should have a section defining the state of fact and law. We have, the subcommittee chose not to have such a section. I raised the issue that I think you ought to have that kind of a section, at least in the areas where there could be pretty obvious agreement. What could be relied upon as a state of fact or law?
Well, we discussed renunciation in subcommittee the other day. Now, are you talking about renunciation?
No.
No?
Are talking about the first, he's talking about what we had a section 5 under our first draft on, or under preliminary draft number 3 on culpability. We had a section on ignorance or mistake, and providing it as a defense under certain circumstances. This was our section in that draft did not go as far as some of these other states have gone.
What did our section read? Can you read
it? Well, yeah, it read, ignorance or mistake as to a matter of fact or law is a defense if, one, the ignorance or mistake negates the culpable mental state required for the commission of a crime, or two, the statute defining a crime or a statute related thereto expressly provides that the ignorance or mistake constitutes a defense or exemption. Or three, the state of mind created by the ignorance or mistake supports a defense of justification as defined in Article 1.
Well, didn't the subcommittee kick that out because we thought that it shouldn't be tied down in the statute to be a defense anyway if a person could show it? Isn't that basically it?
Well, yeah, I think that's basically was the reason.
But you didn't have in this section a lot of the material that now appears in the Model Penal Code at all. That relates to the official advice of an attorney general, or a district attorney, or an administrative agency, or a statute that's been declared unconstitutional and prior.
Can you
rely on prior?
Can you imagine, though, that anybody would actually be convicted of anything? I can't even imagine being brought up to court in a situation where he says, well, the Attorney General wrote an opinion and said you don't have to do that.
That it had to do greatly with intent.
Well, after Ralph Ginsburg.
Which is
aren't there two separate problems, mistake of fact and mistake of law? Mm-hmm. I'm surprised that they're dealt with together. But mistake of law, when you're talking about lawyers' advice, I would imagine lawyers, for example, advise corporations in antitrust matters every day. Well, we're real close to the line, it shouldn't be a defense.
Well, I'm not talking about, as I said, that would be extended pretty far. And it's not proof does not choose to extend the defense to the advice of the lawyer.
And as far as the advice of the district attorney, I know it's our policy never to advise private citizen as to whether what he's going to do is going to be against the law or not. You refer him to a private lawyer. Churches call all the time with raffles or some such thing. I mean, we're not.
But you advise county authorities on the enforcement of law, and if a private citizen relies on what the enforcement is, so he's relying on your opinion, isn't he?
We also determine whether to prosecute or not.
Yeah.
Well, oftentimes we'll get a request for an opinion. Very often it comes from a legislator. It's me. Request opinion from a private citizen.
Mm-hmm. For sure.
That's why it pays every private citizen to know his legislator.
I don't want to prolong the afternoon unduly, but well, I think that this is an area. If you want to look at it this way, you choose to let the court of Oregon make the law rather than the legislature. And generally speaking, you haven't pursued that policy so far. You have chosen yourselves to make the law with respect to definition of crimes rather than leave it to the court. After all, that's why there's so much complaint about the United States Supreme Court. They're making law.
Well, I wonder if whether or not it is a defense doesn't turn on a case-by-case situation here and shouldn't properly be left to judicial construction or interpretation or a fact-finding process by the trier of fact, just as, for example, we decided a while ago on protracted period. that better than to arbitrarily define it, we should leave it. And I think we've done that time and again here. I think it's a good point, but I think maybe we should explore that point in appropriately, and when we come to the part of this article where it's omitted, and that we shouldn't go back to, I'd ask for the question on Bob Chandler's motion to approve the definitions in section one, just to try to hustle us through here.
Any further discussion?
So just one more thing before you leave that. When I was sheriff and asked for district attorney's opinion, and it came back, and I followed that to the letter, that all these opinions, what you're saying, that would relieve me of any responsibility if I did something that was criminal.
Yeah. Shouldn't it?
You
don't have any mental.
Is it a practical?
No.
As would I covered under
that?
It did.
Wouldn't it be covered under that?
What?
That I didn't have any intent or any state of mind that would.
And now he means red.
As a practical matter, of course, it did relieve you, because nobody was going to seek to have you charged or indicted for anything. Jury would have convicted you on it.
I think that's true. Yeah.
No grand jury would have indicted you if the defense attorney had had Willis West come into the subpoena, had him asked for him to go in front of the grand jury and to tell the grand jury that he advised the sheriff to act thusly. I don't know, no grand jury would have indicted you.
You don't think any would?
No.
I don't think so
either.
If I were the defense attorney, that's the first thing. If it got passed, got bound over, that's what I'd do. I'd request the DA bring...
The DA couldn't even ethically prosecute, I imagine.
Now, how would he go in, having given you advice to do something, how the Sam Hill would he be able to prosecute you for it, for having followed that advice?
Wouldn't the state of fact be taken up under willfully and intentionally, and also under specific statutes in which it's a common situation? For example, the mower has good reason to know that we just discussed in a while ago on the self-defense instruction regarding fear, reasonable fear. What I'm saying is that there. Common mistake of fact situations that are frequently taken care of.
There is a situation that there's a lot of case law throughout the country. I don't think there's any case law in Oregon on it. Respect to the crime of bigamy, where the bigamous partner, through reliance on a divorce court order, marries again. And it's frequently held that there is absolute liability for the crime of bigamy. Excuse of mistake of fact and law in this case, based on the judge's opinion, does not excuse a prosecution for bigamy. The minority view, there's only a couple of cases that I know of, a couple of states that hold that that's ridiculous, that you ought to be able to rely on a judge, but there is substantial body of authority which might meet the Oregon court to hold that you can't rely on a judge in Reno to say that you've got a divorce, and you come back to Oregon and marry when you're not legally divorced. Now, these are the kind of problems that may come up that you may not be thinking about.
What I'm saying is that kind of thing can be taken care of in the definition of bigamy offense.
Well, but isn't it a problem with all offenses again? Shouldn't that be dealt with respect to the whole code rather than one particular crime, singling out one crime and giving the defense there where we need the attention elsewhere?
I can't see the language that Don was reading. Can't quite see where the objection to the inside position is.
Well, I think it's simply because it's too easy to defend. Well, I thought it was okay.
Yeah, then what limits do you put on that? You can just go up and say, well, police officers, they don't have the right to do that?
Well, there are limits here in the draft. That would be because he's not the officer charged with the responsibility.
Who's got the draft then?
Whatever it is.
Well, yeah, this was in the earlier draft number three. But it was a fairly mild provision compared to some of these others. Of course, the real area of discussion is with respect to the ignorance of, or mistake of law, not so much a mistake of fact, because if you have a mistake of fact, you're probably not going to have the culpability that's required, or you would have a defense of justice.
Are you getting into a situation like that? I mean, are those particular odd crimes where the law has traditionally been that the mistake of any sort is done excused?
We weren't able to find any cases, not only in bigamy, but any of the criminal cases where this defense was stateless. I mean, any Oregon cases. But
the only case where mistake of fact came up at all is with respect to the crime of attempt, and that's a different context than mistake of fact entirely than what we're talking about here.
The model penal code commentary with respect to this question of reliance upon an official statement of the law, reliance upon an invalid or erroneous or say a repealed statute that the defendant didn't know had been repealed or some administrative order or something. They say that there's some statutory and decisional support for such defenses, though the principles have not been generalized to the extent presented here, and there is of course much contrary authority. Question of reasonable reliance upon a statement of the law, the California commentators have not yet decided on this, apparently, and in this area they feel this is the one area where there is more of a chance of a spurious defense being raised. I don't know whether they've resolved it or not. But so when I drafted this section
notice
5...
by the way, the model penal code, this is one of the real rare occasions where the preponderance of the evidence must be proved by the defendant. Gets back to some discussion earlier.
Yeah.
One place in the model penal code, Mr. Defendant, you've got to prove your defense by preponderance of the evidence. That only occurs 2 or 3 times in the model penal code. To eliminate those kind of spurious reasons.
All right, you've heard the motion on the definition portion of this. All those in favor will say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, no. Motion is carried. Section 2.
Right, provides the minimal requirement for criminal liability is either performance of the person's conduct, which includes a voluntary act, or the omission perform an act that she is capable of performing. He's not guilty of a crime unless he has the culpable mental state with respect to each material element of the crime that necessarily requires a culpable mental state. Now, 3, though, provides that really for the strict liability type of situation, if it's a violation, rather than a crime, and unless the statute specifically so designates, or the statute defining a crime clearly indicates a legislative intent to dispense with any culpable mental state requirement. The subcommittee didn't feel that it wanted to go so far as to say that there won't be any strict liability offenses, period. Of course, there are a lot of arguments in favor of eliminating entirely from a penal code any strict liability crimes. And this is, I think, a very important policy decision for the commission, whether or not you want to have limited criminal liability without culpable mental state, or whether you want to provide that cannot commit a crime under any circumstances unless there is one of the culpable mental states that we've set out here, intentionally or knowingly, recklessly, or with negligence, with criminal negligence. This takes a middle of the road policy and says that in some instances that there may be statutes that provide.
What would they be?
people can have a lot of, well, a lot of your, all your regulatory statutes, are a good part of them, don't require a culpable mental state.
May impose a loss of liberty for up to 6 months. Those who left intentionally by this, but they sort of automatically assume that they're, you made your decision and they're going to be left in court.
Failure of the inward fire.
Well, we can't foresee what the legislature may want to do. I think that we should leave the door open in the event that this evolves eventually, whether it's strict liability crime.
Well, I suppose
we're not having
furnishing liquor to a minor would be under a present.
I think it would be useful here. It wouldn't change the Bill of Rights policy at all. A lot of penal code provides that in statutes outside the code, and there's going to be a lot of them.
Yeah.
The regulatory statutes, in other words. But where those statutes provide for imprisonment, that's what we're talking about, not fines, imprisonment. Where that provision exists, the state may exact that sanction, but only if it proves, at least minimally, there's negligence, although the statute doesn't require it. Otherwise, only a violation may exist. In other words, only the fine may be imposed. So it does affect the other statutes, whereas this does leaves their policy presently standing. Penal code would affect them by saying, okay, you're not going to be able to put anybody in jail unless the state proves minimally negligence in the public welfare violation. And that seems to make sense because there's a lot of criticism of sending someone to jail, not finding them, but sending them to jail for something that they have absolutely no criminal intent about or mens rea about. No concept in the open, clear blue sky that they were doing something criminal.
Was that considered at all, Don?
Was that the model? Yeah, we talked about this.
In the subcommittee? I mean, incorporating into our code the provision that with respect to regulatory violations, that there can be no imprisonment unless there is a minimal element of negligence.
No, that specific thing was not, that I can recall, we didn't discuss that specifically.
That sounds like a reasonable thing because, as Jake mentioned, the Farris case, I think that would be covered in criminal negligence. And the other things would probably be of such a minor nature that you probably do want to have that safeguard in there.
Is that,
there's some recent case law, you know, it's beginning to change it. But it's, you probably know the cases a lot better than I do, but it's very spotty. I mean, not only from state to state, but also from type of statute to type of statute. You can't even reconcile them sometimes within the same state. But occasionally, a court just recognizes it's too harsh to impose a criminal penalty in a situation where there is no actual negligence on the part of the offender, or I should say the violator. That as counterposed to others, where that says, for let's say, for example, that a landlord has an obligation to if he doesn't know about the condition of the safety of his premises, to find out, to be aware of it, and to take care of it, just to pick one particular area. So what I'm saying is that there's some spotty, more recent type law that judicially requires it. I would imagine that this is subject probably to the wave of the future.
How are we going to categorize or classify those crimes, whatever you want, violations that are outside of this code? For example, a landlord in Oregon doesn't have any duty to repair. It's on the lessee, but you're thinking of administrative agencies and violation of those. I suppose we could classify them simply by saying violations that are not covered by this code, I suppose.
No,
or would you say of administrative agencies?
Yeah.
Or does the penal code have specific language on
it? You call them unclassified misdemeanors or something, don't they?
Would that apply
to
all?
Wouldn't
you
just say notwithstanding?
Would that apply to sentences by municipal notwithstanding any other provision of the?
Yes.
Well, here's what
the
law,
as well as the State Public Utilities Commissioner and.
It would the all the state agencies now the municipalities, if it's a violation of ordinance, and no, I don't think this would cover any violation of any city ordinance, because that's a different jurisdiction whose crime has been, whose law has been violated. So it would apply only to the state agencies, wouldn't it? State traffic offenses, yeah, but not necessarily city traffic offenses.
It will.
Why not?
If you adopt a policy here that following the model penal code that I just sort of sketchily outlined for the state, if the city has a conflicting provision requiring imprisonment, it's thrown out, because there can't be a criminal law in a city that's in contrary or in conflict with the state law.
We couldn't write a statute that was
in
conflict with the federal laws.
So it will indirectly amend those provisions.
No, not the federal. But you see, there's certain areas that a state can preempt taxation.
The higher jurisdiction always controls them, so the city couldn't write an ordinance that would conflict with this any more than we could. The legislature could write
it. I think that's right.
This is the
section 2 here. We're talking about criminal liability, we're talking about criminal code. Within our criminal code, we have violations. And we're saying that there's no criminal liability for violation unless. But here we're talking about something else.
We're talking about outside. George wants to go beyond this code and have this apply to all regulations agencies. Where imprisonment might
be. It seems to me that I don't disagree with the suggestion. I think one of the things the legislature is going to have to address itself to in this session, a lot of legislators asked me if we were addressing ourselves to it in this work, and that is bringing into some sort of a reasonable conformity all the various statutory penalties that are section 990 of every chapter of the ORS. We have been removing all the verbiage and just making most of those just, when it come up, just say violation of this chapter is a misdemeanor. Mm-hmm. But I wonder if maybe doing what George suggests isn't something separate and apart from what we're charged with doing here, and if that shouldn't be handled, maybe it's a separate thing.
I don't think so at all. I think this is a vital issue. Anytime there's a loss of liberty statute involved, you've got a very crucial criminal law question. Any of these regulatory 990 provisions, many of them have a loss of liberty or imprisonment criminal sanction. And this directly would affect the way they operate.
Now, I assume what this says, it still says you just can't send them to camp.
But it does allow you then to use the 990 provisions as they now exist without ever amending them at all. If the state will go to the trouble of proving the least negligence.
Is that 2.02 of the model penal code, or what's the...
205 subparagraph 2.
Yes, 205 parent 2, close parent.
205.
Notwithstanding any other provision of existing law, unless a subsequent statute otherwise provides.
What did we do with death or injuries resulting from escaping fires?
Pardon?
We didn't.
We were discussing at one time. Forests or fields.
Well, we put that back in the forestry code.
Yeah, that's right. That's what we did.
We definitely sidestepped it. Thanks, Don.
After we carried the day, we lost it.
Yeah.
Of course, you could show negligence in those, couldn't you?
Well, I suppose you got the case of the guy you pick up for a faulty vehicle. Got a faulty vehicle. And, may not know it. Have a reason to know it.
Would failure to inspect constitute negligence and be justifiable grounds for saying that he had no reason to know it? Well, it'd still be a question of proof in each case, wouldn't it? Whether negligence could be demonstrated or not.
And if it can't be demonstrated, of course, the state would still be entitled to a fine.
Fine, yeah.
And that those provisions always have a fine and or, usually an and or imprisonment.
This is a policy decision. I would move that we accept this as the policy.
Well, I'll go ahead and act on that or ask for a vote if you want, Don. I'm just wondering, we have 7 of 13 members present. This is a pretty crucial thing. Do you think the 7 should make that?
Okay, well, let's put it over then until we do have more representatives.
I think that that's what we should do, but we mustn't forget it, because I think it is important that we act on it. But that doesn't deter us from continuing with the rest of this, does it?
No.
All right, Don, would you put that on the agenda for the next meeting? Because I'm inclined to agree with.
Georgia, are you contemplating that the exact language of 205 section 2 be used?
No reason why not. I don't see any conflicts with anything we've done yet.
I did it more simply.
You're right. This is one thing about the Model Penal Code. They take a long way around sometimes to get what they want to say.
I'm not sure if I understand what they say yet after reading it.
I agree that it should go over. I don't have any personal objection to it. The more I think about it, the more I think perhaps we should do it. But I like it.
All right, Don. Where were we?
All right, that was on the general requirements of culpability. And Section 3 then just goes on to set out the construction or guidelines for construing the statutes with respect to culpability. Says under sub 1 that if the statute prescribes a culpable mental state but does not specify the element to which it applies, that it will apply to each material element of the crime.
Well, let me ask you a question at this point. Can you recall any of the substantive provisions that we've adopted here wherein the statute or the proposed statute doesn't make clear the element of the crime to which the culpable mental state applies?
I think that the ones that have been drafted up to now, for example, if we use knowingly, that property stored.
The reason this provision is here is to provide against bad drafting techniques. What happens sometimes in states is the crime will be stated this way: it's against the law to knowingly A and B and C without repeating the word knowingly before B and C. It becomes ambiguous then. Well, what's the intent with respect to the B and C elements? This says that it's the same as it would be for A.
Yeah, it applies to all of them. Okay.
And then we go on to say, and which again would take care of an omission in drafting, that if the statute doesn't prescribe a mental state, that one is nonetheless required. That a crime is not committed unless the person acts knowingly, intentionally, or recklessly.
Well, that serves about the same purpose as George described in the last bit.
Now, the next one is sort of a lesser included type of culpability. It says that if the statute prescribes that you can commit a crime by acting with criminal negligence, that you can violate that statute by acting with a greater degree of culpability.
Uh-huh.
Intentionally, knowingly, or recklessly. And then we go on to spell it out.
No, he's
recklessness is a culpable mental state is also established if a person acts intentionally or knowingly. When acting knowingly suffices, then it's established that he acts intentionally. Knowledge that conduct constitutes an offense, or knowledge of the existence, meaning, or application of the statute defining an offense is not an element unless the statute clearly so provides. You're not required to know that it's an offense. And getting back to this mistake of law would really amount to an exception to that, or a limited exception to this statement. Then section 4 is pretty much a restatement of our existing law on intoxication.
But it's a little bit more liberal, isn't it?
Yeah.
Let me interject something, can I?
Sure.
I had a preliminary hearing yesterday. A guy who's had two hard falls. He tried to pick up a woman in a bar who was in a wheelchair. This woman is in a wheelchair, and she wouldn't let him pick her up. So he followed her out of the bar, stole her purse, and ran her wheelchair down Southwest Morrison Street, which is kind of a steep street. Yeah.
Oh, you'll take anyone.
Yeah, I was just going to say it. So
don't ask.
Well, if we had this section here, I think I could get him off, because he does not remember. He was drunk. He doesn't remember. I think his intoxication would negative the intent under this draft. I'm not so sure that it does under the present law.
Well, I think if you'd prove that he tried to pick up a woman in a wheelchair in the first place, that he had
belongs to the institution.
This is unbelievable preliminary hearing, because can you think of a worse crime?
What do you do about the crime?
All right, that's the end of my digression.
Of course, the model penal code goes much further than this in its intoxication provisions. And
you cannot commit a crime while drunk. Model penal code.
Well,
no, it's exactly the same as far as this goes.
As far as this part of it.
Yeah.
But they get into, they use the term self-induced intoxication and define that. And then they use pathological intoxication, which would get to your question about the chronic drunk.
That pathological intoxication concept has been adopted in one of the circuits just recently in the federal system. Adopted the model penal code version with respect to that. The case of a drunken Indian, as I recall, is quite interesting. I used to know my husband's English.
But
our third draft
followed the model penal code, and the reason we followed the model penal code was because in the subcommittee that discussed the question of the insanity defense, criminal responsibility, that subcommittee made the decision. There was discussion, I think, on your first draft on responsibility as to whether or not an intoxication section would be included in the responsibility draft, or whether it would be placed under the culpability. That subcommittee number 3 decided that it should not be part of the responsibility draft. So, in line with the direction of that subcommittee, we followed nonetheless the model penal code provisions on intoxication, which was considered in subcommittee number 1. But so it does appear in our earlier draft, but the subcommittee, if I'm not mistaken, was of the opinion that it wished to stay pretty much with our existing Oregon law on the question of intoxication.
Okay, what's your pleasure?
You have a nice long hairy debate on it.
I move we adopt 3 and 4.
Motion's been
made. 2, 3, and 4. 2 subject to revision based upon the absolute liability suggestion of Jordan's for later date.
All right, you've heard the motion, adopt approval of 2, 3, and 4, subject to modification of 2 after we have considered the penal code approach to proof of a minimum of negligence before it can be incarceration. All those in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. Motion is carried. Now, Don, you wanted to discuss item 6. Placement of provisions relating to time limitations, jurisdiction, place of trial, and so forth.
Yes, now, Article 1 of the Model Penal Code, beginning with Section 1.06, time limitations, and it goes on 1.07, method of prosecution when conduct constitutes more than one offense, 1.08, prosecution barred by former prosecution, and the same for the same offense, 109, former prosecution for a different offense, 1.10, former prosecution in another jurisdiction, 1.11, former prosecution before a court lacking jurisdiction. Are sections that the counterparts of which now appear as part of our criminal procedures sections. Now, my question was whether or not the Commission wished us to follow the Model Penal Code in that respect, and in our substantive code include sections that now appear as part of our criminal procedure code, or whether you wish to defer action in this area until we get to procedure, and or a combination of the two. Some of maybe the Commission may feel that there are some sections here that we should deal with now. Because in the absence of these provisions, our preliminary sections under Article 1 would be drafted.
Jake, what do you think? Don, what are, you've expressed them to me. What are your thoughts on it?
Well, I feel that we should deal with these as part of the procedural code.
Would these be the first items that we would take up in considering the procedural code?
Well, they could be. Certainly, we could deal with these.
Yes. Well,
probably should, I would think.
General purpose.
Does anyone have any objection to pursuing that course?
I think it's part of the procedure.
I think you have your answer. If there's no objection, that's what we'll do. You have anything further?
No, Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Chairman, I would just like to somehow or other get some official recognition that I would like Subcommittee 1 to look into the possibility of making it a duty for citizens to come to the aid of persons in immediate peril.
Are you on that subcommittee? Well, you're certainly in a position to do that.
No, he's not on subcommittee.
He's not on that subcommittee.
No, I'm not on that subcommittee.
Oh, that's what I meant.
You've got an ally on that subcommittee, don't you?
Yeah.
That's this one here, the abilities.
Yeah. Well, what about that? We'll discuss that in every meeting of subcommittee number 1.
I can't argue it very well, I guess. Never get any further than that.
You know, it seems to me the main resistance to that idea is simply the lawyer's mind that thinks negatively about something new and different.
Well, here's an example. I know Bruce Balling feels rather strongly that this shouldn't be made a...
doesn't want to make squealers out of the citizenry, is the way you put it.
That's right. But the example I used Thursday, I'm driving down the road and somebody passes me going 110 miles an hour and they're all over the road and they're obviously drunk. I don't stop to at the wayside phone, which is readily available for me to use, call the highway patrol, and 10 miles on down the road, I come upon that car piled into another one, and that person subsequently is charged with negligent homicide. Now, am I liable to prosecution as a principal? Well, strike that. But am I liable to prosecution for violating my duty to report that person's conduct?
John, you've got at least two separate questions. One is the failure to report the commission of a crime. The other is failure to come to the assistance or seek assistance for a person in danger. You know, think about the kids floundering in the lake kind of situation.
That's the one I'm most concerned about.
Well, anybody on that highway is in danger of that person's conduct, and I didn't come to their assistance, did I?
That's correct, but I still think you're dealing with two separate problems. One is the furnishing of witnesses to the state, for example, you know, which apparently Bruce doesn't approve of. The other, though, is essentially a rescue situation.
Don, did you have in mind situations where a request has been made for aid?
We use three examples. One is the little baby is floundering in the pool, and the guy stands by, as Jake says, taking notes for a short story he's going to write about this. The other one is the guy with his mistress in the hotel room that watches her going through these death throes and doesn't call any ambulance, doesn't call the doctor, doesn't call the police, doesn't call any aid corps, just watches her die. And the other one was the Genovese case in New York, where they watch this girl repeatedly attacked and stabbed and everything else, and everybody just watches it, you know, from the window. Nobody picks up the phone and calls the police. I think there should be a duty, a statutory duty, to people to come to the aid of those people in a immediate peril to life.
How do they come to the aid?
With a criminal sanction?
In a reasonable kind of way.
Wait, now, so I'm walking up Sixth Street past the public service building, and three guys run out of the Metropolitan Branch of the U.S. National with guns, and I hear somebody from within the door say, "Hold up, hold up," and I just stand there and watch them. Now, I don't go to anybody's aid because I know damn well if I do, I'm going to get my head blown off.
Okay, I think there's two things.
Yeah, but I think you got a duty to take the license number of the car they drive off in and then give it to the first...
Although you're still hanging out, I'm talking about somebody's immediate threat to life, where they're actually in the throes of this, they're dying or something, or they're going to die if you don't do something. Now, you're talking about a crime that doesn't have the element. And secondly, I think you have to have what a reasonable person would do under the circumstances. The example I used, I don't expect an 80-year-old woman to dive off the Hawthorne Bridge in the middle of the Willamette River to try to save a longshoreman who's falling off. That would not be reasonable to do.
How about the reverse?
In any case, it'd be reasonable to expect them to yell bridge tender, say,
All right, take the case in New York. The gal is getting stabbed. You're standing there on the street. Maybe you happen to be a very timid individual and you're just scared of the hell. You see a knife and you run.
Yeah, but 38 people watched that one.
On the other hand, they might have called the police.
Yeah, we don't expect them to. I don't expect them to go roaring up there and put themselves in the place of the police department. And
I can tell you of a case that just recently happened in Portland where you might have an interesting question. There's a guy sat right near our house. Guy in an automobile accident went to somebody's yard and the car caught on fire. Now the people there, from all I understand, really quite stupidly, instead of going out and trying to get the guy out of the car, went in and called the police. And apparently, the whole neighborhood around there feels that those people were quite stupid in what they did. Quite a bit of hard feeling. In fact, the people have left the neighborhood.
Don, you're thinking of situations where somebody's life is in danger.
That's right. And that citizens should have a duty, and a duty to either inform a proper authority or to take some action themselves, whatever is reasonable.
You're imposing a criminal sanction for a person's lack of judgment, perhaps.
Bad citizenship.
Or frightened and unaware of what they should do. Just dumb.
That's a
then
good
go
defense.
Back to culpability here.
That's a good defense.
That's exactly what I was thinking.
It's a good defense.
But if you're
if
going
I'm
back to
culpability,
then Don, you have to broaden that. Say, and if they are aware that this is what they should do, what if they don't know about this law? And there are a lot
that
of
really bothers me, and I think maybe that's what bothered Don. Is this this basic attitude that people don't want to get involved. They want to stay away from trouble. They want to avoid things.
You think it solves it, but really the question...
No, I don't think it solves it.
Would it do any good if you put a, make it a crime?
Yes, I think it will, and I don't think it's going to solve it, and I don't think you're going to have very many prosecutions under it.
Well, it's a policy statement from the state of Oregon. We expect citizens to do this.
And I don't think you're going to have very many prosecutions under anything else, but I'd like to see the... I'd like to see the sixth grade civics class spend a little time on it for the next 20 years. This sort of thing. No, I think it's a policy statement from the state that, that a citizen has an affirmative duty if he wants to, if he wants to benefit from the system, if he wants to use the law and the courts to protect himself, then he jolly well can assist it to protect others.
We got a good Samaritan statute in the state.
We passed one in 67, remember?
Yeah, they're very popular in 65 and 67. They got passed all over the country.
Anybody that sued Bracky with good intention and everything anyway, even in that regard.
Well, I think...
I don't know, before I would go along with something like that, it would have to be spelled out pretty carefully because...
I would want it spelled out carefully also.
Oh, yeah. I'm not looking for a great big broad sweeping thing where any officer can arrest anybody who was standing on the street as this guy ran down the street.
Every time he goes arrest
the guy,
and
the second one follows up and arrests everybody else on the street.
But if he alerted to immediate peril, that guy in the river, I think I should have a legal obligation to do something about it. As of now, I can stand there and say, how many more times are you going to bob up and down before he goes under for the last time?
You mean a rescue statute?
Yeah. But I must, at least the bare minimum, I should tell the bridge tender, hey, there's somebody down there found in the water. So somebody can do something about it. Or the guy in the hotel room with his mistress, I think that guy ought to stand up and he has a responsibility to that life.
Or this isn't really more of an area of civil liability, though.
Or the...
better law than civil law is not.
Or the first Albina riot case that I had in 64 when the five motorcycle policemen went on to the field over at Jefferson after the Grant High School Jefferson game and tried to disperse the kids, and the kids swarmed in on top of the officers and tipped the bikes over and started throwing rocks at them and very seriously injured. One man had to retire from the department because of a rock, but he got hit in the chest and gave him a heart failure. And citizens standing on the street watching that saying, getting what you deserve, copper. In that situation, that policeman was in immediate peril. Should that person on the street corner be subjected to criminal sanction because he didn't come to his aid?
Not because he didn't come to his aid necessarily, but for at least, at the very least, failure to call some help. We got another problem. Bang your gavel.
Well, I think it's a big question, Mr. Chairman. Could I suggest that Don prepare a tentative rough draft?
Very quiet.
You wouldn't notice me if I just...
No, I mean the commission to get a consensus from the a commission whether subcommittee number one should pursue it.
I think that's a good plan.
I think it's futile for the subcommittee of four people to do any work on this if we don't get a consensus from the full commission. And I do think it's a big question.
No, I do too. All right, your problem, Bob.
Well, if I read my calendar right, we have about 12 months to finish our work in. Presuming we want the 1970-1971 legislature.
Well, we've
to adopt
got more
this.
Than that. We can get the. We've got about 15.
Yeah. Presuming we want the 1971 legislature to adopt this monumental work, why we're going to have to have it done far enough in advance to circulate it and do some other things and get the troops lined up and get the League of Women Voters on our side or whatever we've got, whoever we've got to get on our side. All right, the Civil Liberties Union, then. In the meeting, we have calendar problems as evidenced today.
Yeah.
And I'm wondering if it might not be a good idea to start now, or whether it's worth considering starting now with setting up from now on during the rest of this period, two consecutive days at regular intervals, one to be devoted to committee meetings, and one to be devoted to a full commission meeting. Committees hopefully would keep far, would have to stay far enough ahead of the commission so that they wouldn't be working on something Friday or Thursday and then bring it to the commission on Friday before we have time to do the drafting changes and the copying changes and get the notebooks and everything else.
That's a good idea.
It would seem to me that, from my calendar standpoint, be a lot easier to say that we will meet the third Thursday and Friday of each month from now on, or that we will meet the third Thursday or the Thursday and Friday every third week if we decide we have to meet oftener than monthly. But at least to just sit down and start out and say, from now on, we're going to do this, and then we could have a chance in some of these people's cases to arrange calendars.
Well, Don and I have been talking about this a lot, and I don't know what the best way is. I thought at one time perhaps it'd be best to just continue staying on the telephone with respect to a certain day, but I think your idea is a good one, and I'd like to implement it as soon as possible. Don, what is the status of subcommittee work right now, for example, with respect to the next meeting?
Well, subcommittee number one has a backlog of drafts to work on. Not large, but we do have one draft before the subcommittee now that we have considered and taken no action, needs further work. Then we have one other draft that has not yet been considered by that subcommittee. With subcommittee number two, we're about three drafts ahead now. The staff work is three drafts ahead of the subcommittee. And as far as having a definite day each month, as far as the staff's concerned, we can meet whatever schedule the commission wants. My only question would be that with respect to the drafts that George Platt is working on, whether or not this is going to be a feasible arrangement with subcommittee number three. George is not working full time.
Well, responsibility, all right, we'll be ready for this commission.
We decided Thursday
within a week
at our subcommittee.
The color crimes are the only other one I'm working on. Later, but it's waiting subcommittee action.
We're going to meet on Monday in July. We'll meet on July 7th on a Monday. The commission's Bruce had a.
As far as you're concerned, starting that morning, if we say subcommittee is up to
the responsibility on the next agenda of the commission, if you want to. Assuming that you can process any time, I have to have a week to get it to you.
Yeah, I wasn't thinking so much as far as responsibility or in court crime was concerned, but as far as future work, if we said that subcommittee number three is going to meet on the second Thursday of each month, will you be able to meet that schedule?
Mm-hmm.
Certainly as far as two subcommittees, we can hack it on that basis.
So there's one court. That's what, anyway, we're going to be.
Of course, one generates work for the other. If the subcommittees are active on a regular basis, then this is going to generate material for the commission to act on. I don't want us to impose a. I don't want us to impose an unconscionable burden on you.
Yeah. Why don't you prepare a memorandum setting forth, for example, July 20? Is Friday and Saturday the best for everyone, or Thursday and Friday, or what's the best?
I think Friday and Saturday is better.
It's better for me.
Better for you, Dave.
I was just telling Tony what we're going to do in sub three or one. Starting in July, we're going to meet every third Friday. And we found, I think, that meeting at 1:30 in the afternoon is, for the subcommittee meeting, is most productive. We tried mornings and late afternoon and everything, but we find that after about 4 hours in subcommittee, we reach the point of diminishing returns. So if we meet every third Friday at 1:30 in the afternoon, and then we had a commission meeting on Saturday, those that come from a great distance like Bob and
Tony, for example, to
certainly
stay all
better
night.
For me.
Well, that's
two days in a row.
It really becomes a problem. I've got the same thing today and tomorrow, and it's a lot easier to stay here tonight than it would be the intervening day. Lots of the time, there's no help at all.
Don, why don't you write to every member and tell them what we've discussed here generally? And since they're meeting the third Friday, say that henceforth, unless there's some violent objection, and that you want them known if they are, that it'll meet on the third. The third Friday and Saturday of July, August, September, and right on down.
That'll get a set of meetings.
Then they'll at least be able to plan.
Once a month, that'll be.
Friday,
you
Saturday.
Still ought to be able to keep up
with it. I think.
Now, you're talking about a commission meeting, a 2-day commission meeting,
no.
Or one day for subcommittee?
One day for subcommittee.
Well, now, assuming that all three subcommittees meet on Friday, you got enough girls to go around, you don't have enough of you and Roger.
Well. Of course, one of those subcommittees will be George's.
Oh, that's right.
See?
Yeah, that's right.
And we don't have enough project directors to go around, is my problem. I mean, it'd just be a question. I wouldn't be able to be in all subcommittee meetings, as I've been in the past.
Well, that'd be all right.
That's the whole purpose.
Let's see what they say to that.
Yeah.
Now,
that'd
may
be
I?
The 20th and 21st. July.
No,
see the
18th and 19th, that's June.
Oh, 18th and 19th of July.
It'll
be the third Friday and Saturday.
So we'll have two section meetings pretty close together. We'll have the 7th of July and the 18th. But then we'll be in. I think that's
all right.